Welcome to Wrongful Conviction, False Confessions. I'm Laura Nyreiter.
And I'm Steve Drizin.
In our previous episode, we talked about how the interrogation room works. Today, we're going to show you. Steve and I are going to tell you about a young man named Robert Davis. This is a frightening story of a murder investigation that went horribly wrong. Robert's was one of the first false confession cases I worked on, and I'll never forget it, because it taught me how easily an ordinary person can get caught up in a web of injustice. We first learned about Robert Davis back in 2011. The story came from a local newspaper out of Charlottesville, Virginia.
I was in a space at the time where I was looking for false confessions wherever I could find them. And one day, an article about Robert's case turned up in my news feed. And when I read the article, I was attracted to it for a number of reasons. One was that there was a recording of the entire interrogation process. And that's sort of the gold that everybody was looking for. Can you see how police manipulate an innocent suspect into confessing to a crime they didn't commit?
Yeah, I mean, so many people think that's only for extremely young children, that's only for intellectually limited people. But Robert Davis is every man. He's us. He's a normal guy. In every sense, you know, to the extent there is a normal person. Robert Davis could be your neighbor. He could be your kid's friend. And there's no better illustration of the power of the interrogation room, the way these techniques work, the way they can transform the innocent into the guilty in a matter of hours than this case.
After receiving the interrogation video, I knew I had to get involved in this case, and I knew I had to work on it with Laura.
Robert Davis's case was my first case where I became involved as an expert. The interrogation video, you know, it's one of the most coercive videos I've ever seen. It speaks for itself. It's horrible to watch. And it calls out for action.
In many ways, Robert's case was an early incarnation of the kind of clemency campaign that Laura and I recently mounted in the case of Brendan Dassey, using clips from the interrogation to tell what had happened to him, bringing in experts from different fields, including law enforcement, to weigh in on what was wrong with that interrogation and helping to personalize Robert through the media.
Robert Davis's story begins in Crozet, Virginia, a middle-class suburb of Charlottesville. Robert lived in a small house with his mom, and they were really close. In the winter of 2003, he was a senior in high school, and with graduation just a few months away, Robert was looking forward to the next phase of his life. But on the night of February 19th, a terrible tragedy happened on Robert's block. Fire broke out in a neighboring house, the home of a young mother and her three children. The fire department is called. They arrive at the scene. It's a snowy night, right? Snowflakes are coming down fast and furious. Firefighters get there. They battle through the snow. They put out the fire. And once the fire is subdued, they go upstairs to one of the bedrooms, which is where they find the body of the homeowner, a 41-year-old woman named Nola Charles. And when they turned Nola's body over, they saw a knife in her back. And suddenly it became very clear that this fire had been set to cover up a murder.
Then the firefighters walk down the hallway to look in some of the other bedrooms. This is a very small house, so it was just a short walk. And under some debris, they found the body of Nola's young son, Thomas Charles. And he had died of smoke inhalation. You know, this was a horrific crime, any way you slice it. You know, the murder of a mother, the death of a small child, stabbings, an arson to try to cover up the crime. This is something that would have been unheard of in Crozet and just would have been a complete and total shock to the entire community.
An investigation starts, and pretty soon the police identify some likely suspects. It's actually two other teenagers. Their names are Rocky and Jessica Fugit. Rocky was 19. He was also a senior in high school, like Robert Davis. But he was somebody who had a really troubled past. He'd struggled with drug addiction, with alcohol addiction. And he'd gotten in trouble with the police for doing things like leaving dead birds in church sanctuaries. His sister, Jessica, was 15, and she had struggled her whole life with mental illness, delusions, hallucinations. She was somebody who really grappled with her own demons. And she was friends with Nola Charles' teenage daughter, Wendy. But Jessica didn't like Wendy's mom. Jessica was known to have a grudge against Nola Charles. And so, based on all this information, the police picked up Rocky and Jessica within only a few days of this fire, and they bring them down to the police station for questioning. And soon enough, the two of them confess that they were involved in the killing of Nola Charles and the setting of the house on fire. After they confessed, Jessica led the police to a snowy field behind Nola Charles' home, where she and Rocky had buried an iron bar that had been used to bludgeon Nola Charles before she was stabbed. And that iron bar still had Nola's DNA all over it. So Jessica was able to lead the police to this new evidence that they didn't know about that corroborated her confession. The confession's true. Rocky and Jessica are guilty. They've never said otherwise. Case closed. And if this was the end of the story, right, we wouldn't be telling it to you. But it's not the end of the story. Because the police were convinced that Rocky and Jessica had not acted alone. And they each started rattling off a list of names, other kids in their high school. The police determined that each one of these other high schoolers had an ironclad alibi, until the last name on the list, which is Robert Davis. Robert had been at home, alone, asleep. Not a very good alibi. So the police decided to bring him in for questioning, too.
Now, from the get-go, Robert Davis and Jessica and Rocky being together in the same space committing a horrific crime made no sense at all. These two kids picked on Robert, especially Rocky. The idea that Robert would be with them and would commit a murder was absurd, and it didn't take a lot of smarts to see that.
But nonetheless, right, the police go and pick up Robert Davis. They bring him in for questioning in the middle of the night. Now, before we hear what happens next, I want to stop for a minute and talk to you about how interrogations work. Obviously, the goal is to get the suspect to confess to the crime, but how does that happen exactly? In the last episode, Steve and I shared some of what we've learned from watching many hours of interrogation tapes. But as shocking as what we described is, you should know that interrogations used to be even worse. 100 years ago, it was common for police to use physical violence. Innocent and guilty suspects alike were beaten, hung from windows, and otherwise tortured until they confessed just to escape the suffering. Then, starting in the 1940s and 50s, reform was in the air. Physically abusive practices were thrown out. Police were trained to use words instead of fists. And this change seemed like a progressive one at the time. But now we know that psychological interrogation techniques can also be highly problematic. They're very good at persuading actual criminals to admit guilt, but they can also produce false confessions. The manipulation begins with the interrogation room itself. Like Steve said, these rooms are designed to make the suspect feel isolated, cut off from all sources of support or help. This is the type of room where police brought Robert Davis on February 22nd, 2003, at about 1 o'clock in the morning. He's by himself, he's 18 years old, and he's sitting in there alone, not knowing what's happening, you know, terrifying circumstances. And then, all of a sudden, with the video camera rolling, the police come into the interrogation room. Two officers, big, burly guys. And they say to him,
Robert, you're charged with the murder of Nola Charles, of Thomas Charles. You're going to be charged with the attempted murder of the two Charles daughters, Katie and Wendy. Now it's really gotten serious, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Exactly right.
And literally, you know, when you watch Robert react to being accused of murder, you can feel the fear and the panic and the anxiety just radiating off this video. And you can just watch his mind spin. What can I do? What can I do to convince these guys they've got the wrong person? And so Robert says to them what any of us, I think, in that situation would say.
I swear to God all my life right now that I did not do nothing. of this matter. I have nothing to do with this. I will take a polygraph test right now to prove to you that I did not have nothing to do with this.
Interrogation trainers teach law enforcement officers that if a suspect affirmatively asks for a polygraph exam, that that's one indicator of innocence. It's not rock solid proof that somebody is innocent, but it's a powerful statement that they have nothing to fear and that they're willing to put their innocence to the test.
And the officers shut him down. They tell him, no, we don't have a polygraph, even though they actually have one in the room next door. Now, why are they refusing to listen to Robert as he's asserting dozens of times his innocence? Well, that's how officers are trained to interrogate. Interrogation is basically a two-stage process. The goal of the first stage, which we've just heard a little bit of, is to bring the suspect down to hopelessness. This officer is telling Robert that it's pointless to say he's innocent because they already know he's guilty. An interrogator's job is to make the suspect feel trapped using every tool available. And as many people don't realize, these tools can include lying.
Do you know your skin is the worst thing in the world as far as dust? Can you see it?
They say to him, we found your DNA in the house from your skin cells that just shed naturally off you. And of course, this is false, right? The house had gone up in flames. There was no forensic evidence whatsoever recovered from the scene. It's a complete lie. But in the United States, police are allowed to lie during interrogations. And again, you can see radiating off this videotape the terror in Robert's face, right? How can this be? I've never been in that home.
And then the officer says something I have never seen in any other interrogation, and I've seen thousands of hours of interrogations.
I can't lie about the evidence.
I can't lie about the evidence, Robert. I mean, talk about a whopper. Not only can he lie during the interrogations, but he can lie about the evidence, and he's lying about a lie.
Exactly. Talk about a mindfuck.
She just dropped the F word. She dropped the F bomb.
Well, it's appropriate in this case, right? I mean, this is the psychological game that twists the world for people in the box, and it works. Now, let's take a moment to remember that Robert is going through this ordeal completely alone. At 18 years old, he's legally an adult, but even if he were younger, in most states, it's perfectly legal to question a child without notifying their parent or guardian. This is a desperate situation. And like anyone would, Robert asks for the best protector he has. He asks for his mom. But that request is turned around and used to break him down even further.
I really want to talk to mom, please.
I can do that. But I need a little cooperation.
I'm giving you all the cooperation I can.
Then they do something especially insidious. The lead investigator says that he had just had a phone call with Robert's mother, and his mother was crying hysterically on the phone, you know. And this investigator tells Robert, your mom wants you to cooperate. Your mom is saying, Robert, you know, tell the truth so that I can help you to go on with your life.
Right, to save your life, exactly. And of course, that's all made up, right? He didn't actually have this conversation with the mother at all. It's horrible to watch the police twist a mother-child relationship into a bludgeon to be used in the interrogation room. It's a disgusting ploy, deeply manipulative, and it's very hard to watch.
There are other moments that are just, you know, classic. Threats of punishment and promises of leniency. And the calculated choice of words on the part of this officer have always intrigued me.
And I'm trying to keep you from the most ultimate punishment you can get, and you're not even helping me to help you.
He refuses to say death penalty. He uses the words ultimate punishment as if that's somehow less direct a threat, you know? It's an effort to dance around something that everybody knows is true, which is Robert is fighting for his life in this interrogation room.
This is the moment when all of these psychological techniques, all of this mindfuck finally takes hold, and Robert looks up at these officers from the corner of the interrogation room, and he says,
what can I say that I did to get me out of this?
That's the climax of the entire interrogation. What can I say I did to get me out of this? Once the suspect has been brought down to hopelessness, once their will has been broken, that's when the second stage of interrogation begins. This is the moment when the suspect is offered a choice. What's going to happen if they don't confess, and what will happen if they do? For Robert, option number one looks pretty terrible. The ultimate punishment, or best case scenario, 90 years in prison. But on the other hand, the police tell Robert that if he confesses his involvement in the crime, if he cooperates, the judge will go easy on him. He might get as few as 5 to 10 years in prison. And at the very least, they tell him he'll save his own life. The interrogators have finally achieved their goal, to make confessing look like the best choice Robert has.
So you can see Robert breaking down, but he has a problem. He's never been in that house. He's never been with these people. He doesn't know right. who the people are that are accusing him of these crimes. Even if he wants to confess to this crime, he has no idea what happened.
So now the game becomes not convincing Robert that he has to confess, but rather simply telling him what to say. And so that's how the final few hours of this interrogation are spent. Robert starts out not even knowing who his accomplices are. And they have to give him the names Rocky and Jessica. Okay, so Robert adopts those. Yes, I was there with Rocky and Jessica, and we went in the back door of the home. No, in fact, the evidence at the scene was that the entry had occurred through the front door, so the officers have to correct that. No, Robert, the three of you went through the front door. Then he's telling a story in which he and Rocky and Jessica are down on the first floor of the home, and he, Robert, stays down there during the attack. But of course, Nola Charles' body was found in an upstairs bedroom. He's getting it wrong again. So again, no, Robert, you were upstairs. We know you were upstairs. You have to say you were upstairs. And this goes on and on and on.
Would it make you feel better if we told you who was with you?
Wait a minute, I got somebody else clubbing her. You did another act. You know what that act is. You stabbed that woman.
And the amazing thing is that while the officers are feeding Robert all of this information, correcting his mistakes, while they're doing it, there's a level of self-awareness because they say to him, Robert, you realize that if I have to tell you what you did, that defeats the purpose. And then they do it anyway. After Robert creates this confession and seals his own fate, he looks up at these officers and he says, do you think by me telling you all this, it's going to get me home? And the officer looks at him and says, no, you're not going to go home. You'll see a judge on Monday. And Robert looks at him and says,
why am I lying about all this to you just so I can go home?
You're not lying.
I'm lying to you about all of this. It is the clearest recantation I have ever seen.
And the most immediate. I mean, he hasn't left the interrogation room yet.
He thought he was going to go home, back to his mom, back to his high school life. And instead, he is handcuffed and led out of that room to a jail cell where he's booked for double murder and arson, and where, in fact, he is staring at decades in prison. Robert Davis couldn't afford to hire a lawyer, so the court appointed one for him. And when that happens, some people get a lawyer like Len Kaczynski, the guy who botched Brendan Dassey's case in Wisconsin. But for Robert, this was a moment when he finally got some amazing luck, because the lawyer appointed to defend him was a man who's dedicated his life to fighting for people without a voice.
My name's Stephen Rosenfield. I've been practicing law for 43 years. I'm a civil rights lawyer.
Steve Rosenfield is one of my heroes.
Mine too. And when Steve looks at the tape, he sees everything that we've just talked about. He sees that police officers browbeat a teenager into confessing to a crime that he didn't even know how to describe, and that they were the ones who scripted this confession.
Steve threw himself into this case with the passion of a father who saw how worthless this confession was, but who also saw the stakes, the real stakes here, were the rest of this 18-year-old's life.
So the job of a good lawyer when faced with a confession is to try to do everything in their power to keep that evidence out of the trial. and to argue that that confession was involuntary and unreliable. And that's exactly what Steve did.
Our goal was to keep the confession out because it was coerced and did not reflect what really happened on the night of the murders.
Steve litigated this case, fought hard for Robert, hired a psychological expert to talk about the tactics that were used by police officers, and he pointed out all of the highlights that we've been talking about.
I was able to call our expert witness, and he went through the kinds of factors that lend themselves toward false confessions, why a young man having been threatened with a death sentence might say that he had done something when in fact he had not.
And if you want to understand the problem of false confessions, why this happens so much, why people are convicted on the basis of confessions like this one, it's because too many judges believe that the law does not clearly prohibit even threats that someone will face death if they don't confess, right? Even cases where they have to be told exactly what to say by their interrogators. This judge didn't think the law prohibited that and allowed this confession into evidence. And when that happened, of course, then Robert Davis had a horrible choice to make.
Knowing Steve, he was very clear and honest with Robert about what the options were and what the chances are of his being convicted.
Confessions are powerful. There was a more than likely chance of him being convicted, and with a conviction surely would have come a very hefty sentence. We were guessing that it would have been a huge number of years or life sentences for the killing of the child and the mother.
Do I go to trial and risk being sent to prison for the rest of my life for something I didn't do? Or do I accept an offer that the prosecution has made to me? If I plead guilty to one count of murder, I will be sentenced to 23 years. Robert was 18 years old when he was arrested.
Right.
So that would mean that he could get out at the age of 41.
Right.
He would still have a life.
Half a life. Yeah.
Half a life. He could have a family. He could have some future.
Right. It's a horrible choice, but it's the kind of choice that defendants face in courtrooms around the country every single day. Robert chose the deal. He entered a plea of guilty in exchange for those 23 years. A horribly difficult, deeply unjust decision that he was forced to make, but also one that I can't fault him for in the slightest. I think any of us in that position would probably do the same thing.
But what Steve said to Robert is, I will not give up on you. I will continue to investigate this case.
Steve Rosenfield promised Robert Davis that he would walk with him, that he would stay with him, he would visit him in prison. He wouldn't forget him.
And Steve also said to him, look, I know you didn't commit this crime, and I know you don't want to say in open court that you did. There is something called an Alford plea that will enable you to save face.
You've got someone proclaiming their innocence, but who doesn't have the power, resources, ability, legal standing to fight the evidence against them. So they cry, uncle, I'm innocent, but I can't fight this. That's what an Alford plea is. We've seen it in many other wrongful conviction cases, most prominently in the West Memphis 3 case.
One of the consequences is that you can't sue the state for violating your civil rights. The Alford plea disqualifies you from recovering any compensation for the years, sometimes decades, you've spent in prison.
It's a tool of injustice. Should not exist, but it does. And that's the tool that was used to secure Robert Davis's 23-year prison sentence. Steve Rosenfield kept his promise. Even while Robert served his time, Steve continued pounding the pavement, looking for new evidence of Robert's innocence. He even reached out to family members of Rocky and Jessica Fugit, who were both serving life sentences in prison. Steve never gave up hope that one day Rocky and Jessica might come forward and tell the truth. And then one day, that hope arrived in the mail.
After about 8 years, I received a letter from the boy who said that his conscience was bothering him and would I come down and visit him. And he told us the truth. He told us that he and his sister were the only two present. He came up with the idea of framing Robert because he thought it could help at his sentencing if the prosecutor was pleased with his cooperation.
It was like manna from heaven, right? The accuser of Robert Davis recants and says, I was wrong. I feel terrible about it. Help me make this right.
The only hope that Robert had was if the governor of Virginia would step in and issue a pardon. And so that's Steve Rosenfield's plan. Let's go to the governor. Let's tell him about Rocky's recantation, and let's highlight all the problems with this interrogation. Now, a local Charlottesville newspaper called The Hook wrote an article about Steve's clemency campaign for Robert. And that's the article that showed up in your news feed, right, Steve?
Exactly. I read that story and I reached out to Steve and I said, what can we do to help? And as we talked, I noticed that Steve had hired a psychological expert for Robert's case, but he didn't have an expert who could really look at the interrogation and say, these are the kinds of tactics that lead to coerced and unreliable confessions. I volunteered our assistance in doing that. I had done some expert work, and I wanted Laura to start doing some expert work. So I assigned Laura the lead role in analyzing this interrogation. But we also offered Steve other ways in which to publicize and highlight Robert's plight. I had worked with a number of producers on NBC's Dateline show, and I reached out to them and I said, this is gold. We have a videotaped interrogation from start to finish. You can actually see on this tape how someone confesses to a crime they didn't commit. And we also reached out to other experts in the law enforcement field to look at Robert's interrogation and to weigh in on all the things that police officers did wrong.
I mean, that's the thing, right? We knew that we needed to elevate Robert's story and bring a community of different people together to push all in their different ways against a system that's designed to keep people in prison. We knew that, you know, public opinion would rally around Robert Davis once people saw this story. We knew that people inside Virginia would care about the way interrogations were being conducted in their state and would hopefully press the governor to do the right thing in Robert's case. And then one more thing happened.
More manna from heaven.
It was Jessica Fugit.
I received a letter from her saying that she knew that she had done wrong by framing Robert and that she wanted to make amends for that.
That's when we started to really believe there was a chance of getting Robert Davis out of prison.
I met with Governor McAuliffe. We talked for about 40 minutes. I suggested to him that he grant at least a conditional pardon and then revisit the case in a year. And that was the grounds under which Governor McAuliffe agreed to release Robert, deciding that with the statements of the two kids, there was a much better likelihood that he would have been found not guilty.
It had been 12 years of incarceration for Robert. And suddenly, a few days before Christmas, he's allowed to go home. It's an incredible moment where you can hear the joy in his voice and in his mother's voice as they embrace for the first time after Robert is freed. It was beautiful, just beautiful.
Robert! Thank you! Thank you!
I'm home, man. Like, I can reach out and not touch nothing. I don't see no gates now. I don't see no fences.
As a part of Dateline documenting Robert's release, they go and speak to the chief of the Albemarle County Police Department, and they ask him how he feels about Robert Davis's release.
I will say this. I believe that the confession is an unreliable confession, using terms like the ultimate punishment, length of the interview.
I know what took place.
Those kinds of things would be clearly not done today.
He was embarrassed by what he saw. And this was somebody from the same police department in the same community reflecting back on what he saw when he looked at the tape.
And with that admission of a mistake, the governor of Virginia, a year later, granted Robert that full pardon based on actual innocence. He exonerated him.
Robert and I have maintained a close relationship all of these years. He's just such a great kid. I call him a kid, mid-30s now. He has an extended family, wonderful friends. He is highly thought of in the community. He's a sweet guy with a big heart. He's very optimistic about the future, and this has been in spite of having spent his formative years in prison. So by and large, he uses every day to enjoy and put behind him some of that ugly past.
That's the thing. I mean, we'd watched on that interrogation video Robert be transformed from just an innocent member of the community into a confessed murderer. And now, 13 years later, we could watch him be transformed back. And it was a beautiful thing to watch the retelling of the story the right way.
Hello.
Hey, Robert. It's Laura. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You just got off work today, huh? What are you doing for a job these days?
I'm doing electrical work, working for the union now. 5 days a week, yeah.
Amazing. Fantastic. I heard you got engaged recently, too. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And she's got a daughter, I hear. So you're the stepdad.
Yep.
That's a lot of responsibility.
It is a lot of responsibility, but I definitely enjoy it.
Oh, that's great.
The one question we're always asked in our work is, why would anyone confess to a crime that they didn't commit? And when you watch the video of Robert Davis, it's the perfect answer to the question, why would anyone confess to a crime they didn't commit? The answer is because they're interrogated like this. When you're fighting a wrongful conviction, what you are doing at the end of the day is trying to rewrite the story that's been told about your client.
You're rewriting history.
Right. You're changing the legacy of what happened. And the story that led to the conviction is a story of guilt, a story of harm, of damage, of pain, and of someone who, at the end of the day, deserves to be locked up in a cage for the rest of their life. That's the story that when you fight a wrongful conviction, that you have to change. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back next week when we'll be telling the story of Chicago's own Central Park jogger case, known as the Dixmoor Five. The Dixmoor Five were a group of teenage boys who confessed to the rape and murder of their own classmate and were convicted, despite some of the strongest evidence of innocence imaginable. Wrongful Conviction, False Confessions is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1. Special thanks to our executive producer, Jason Flom, and the team at Signal Company No. 1, executive producer Kevin Wardus, senior producer Ann Pope, and additional production and editing by Connor Hall. Our music was composed by Jay Ralph. You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter at Laura Nyreiter.
And you can follow me on Twitter at sdrizzen.
For more information on the show, visit wrongfulconvictionpodcast.com. And be sure to follow the show on Instagram at wrongfulconviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction.